This is KLLGLP 97.9 Willits, California. And I am Greg Schindel, trained singer, now boarding the Bipolar Express. All aboard! Chugga, 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 chugga up the hill. Puffin' and a-chuggin', you know that engine will reach the summit and go down the other side. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety-clackety, clickety-clackety-click. Look at the engine, that's old 45. Fired up and ready, she seems to come alive. Listen to that wailing whistle all round the countryside. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety-click. Up the grade she goes, woo! The wheels are slipping. Up the grade she goes until we reach the summit and go down the other side. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety-click. And I have to say, the excitement of the children this time of year gives me a real boost in spirit. We've got Santa, Rudolph, Frosty, Christmas carols, elves, homes decorated in incredible lights. I noticed those lights coming out of Ukiah the other night. Those people, they're out to outdo themselves, I'm sure of it. But sure, what a spectacle. Now, these icons of Christmas haven't changed too much over the years, at least in my lifetime anyway. And they're kind of like Easter. We got eggs and bunnies, and we have hearts and flowers on Valentine's Day, and shamrocks on St. Patrick's Day, and ghosts and witches on Halloween. And these all make me think of the other icons of my childhood, when innocence was a blanket against the realities of life. Now, back when I was a kid, our coins were of silver. A silver dollar was a silver dollar. And we used to strike the edge of a quarter, a silver quarter, with a spoon until it was flattened out. And then we'd drill out the center, polish it, and voila, a silver ring for your girlfriend to hang around her neck. Those were the days, I have to say. I don't want to go too much further here without saying that my good friend Lanny is in the studio with me, and I always feel confident when he's here running the board for me.
I sometimes feel confident when I'm here, too.
Confidence, patience. You know, you have to have patience. Have patience, or be a patient. That's what I say. So anyway, I wanted to go on with this. In the 1930s, there was a silver dime that was minted with the image of the god Mercury, and it was called a Mercury Head Dime. And it was last minted in 1936. And silver coins were discontinued, by the way, in 1964. Another icon of my childhood and this country, gone. Past eras, the good old days. You know, I have this song called The Mercury Head Dime, and it reminds me of a Norman Rockwell painting. Now, I want you to see how many icons of your past you can recognize in this song. Now it's cotton candy, Ferris wheels, birthday cakes and rhymes. All the innocence
of my childhood gone, like the days of the Mercury had died. See the yo-yo spin, rin-tin-tin, shooting marbles in the sun. Oh, there were colored kites and pillow fights and baseball cards with gum. And now those Easter eggs and the toy balloons skip rope of well-spent time. Oh, ride the merry-go-round to yesterday, to the days of the Mercury had died. Now when steam whistles blew, Pullmans were new, hobos had nothing to lose. Miles and miles of tracks and railroad shacks, and my dad, he'd sleep in the caboose. And there was coonskin caps and cracker jacks. Double dare ya, tag you're it. Now it's hide and seek, now don't you peek, and will you cross your heart on it? And there was Superman and Peter Pan. They say Howdy Doody's doing fine, but if the Wizard of Oz could just grant my wish, I would ask for a Mercury dime. And now the Easter eggs and the toy balloons skip rope of well-spent time. Oh, ride the merry-go-round to yesterday, to the days of the Mercury had died. Ah, the merry-go-round to yesterday, the days of the Mercury had died.
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure that Howdy Doody is doing fine, by the way, but I know that Santa Claus is.
Well, how do you know, Mr. Train Singer?
Well, while playing at the Polar Express celebration in Ukiah for Family and Children's Services, I met the real Santa Claus. I mean, the real guy. I know, because I pulled his beard when he was on his cell phone. Well, so let me say, the kids loved him. And you know, Greg, Willits has hosted the longest continuous rodeo in California. So we've got lots of cowboys and cowgirls and ranchers, and, well, they all love Christmas. So, I was thinking, why don't we have a cowboy Santa Claus?
His boots are scuffed and dusty, and his faded jeans are blue. Ah, the wind is right and the stars are bright when he's riding through. He got a lot of range to cover as he travels far and near. He's the cowboy Santa Claus, and he's spreading Christmas cheer. Now the cowboy Santa Claus, you know he wears a Stetson hat, and he's got a red bandana. Oh boy, that cowboy's fat. He got silver spurs that jingle, and he doesn't need a gun, 'cause he got a team of horses. Yee-haw! They can run. Yippee-yah-ho! Yippee-yah-yay! He's the that cowboy, the cowboy Santa Claus. Now horses fast as bullets, I the ride as if untamed. You got blazing star and thunder, he calls them all by name. Stormy flash and lightning, with fury they'll fly. Spirit as their leader, sailing through the sky. Oh, yippee-yah-ho, yippee-yah-yeah. He's that cowboy, the cowboy Santa Claus. Boots for Jesse, and a bridle for old Bud. A saddle and a blanket, and a horseshoe for good luck. Now Jenny gets a pony, and a set of silver spurs. A buckle and a belt, with a name on the back so she'll know it's hers. Yippee-yah-ho! Ah, he's the cowboy Santa Claus. Now if you like cowboys, and you'd like to be one too, just believe that cowboy Santa Claus, he'll soon be riding through. Listen for his team of horses, as they gallop across the sky. That cowboy Santa Claus, he'll never pass you by. Yip-yah-ho, yip-yah-yeah. He's that cowboy, the cowboy Santa Claus. Yip-yah-ho, yip-yah-yeah. He's that cowboy, the cowboy Santa Claus. Ah, he's the cowboy Santa Claus. Hey, cowgirl, he's the cowboy Santa Claus.
Merry Christmas, buckaroos. Hey, maybe the train singer will see you on the magical Christmas train this year. You know, it runs daily until the 23rd. We got Santa, we got elves, we got Mrs. Claus. We got a big old bear, music, cookies, hot chocolate. Don't miss it. Hey, this is KLLG 97.9. We are the home Town Radio, and you are riding on the Bipolar Express. Whoa! Now, this time, I'd like to share some railroad history with you. As I always say, our history is our gold. Now, last week, I introduced our own Boomer Jack, the railroad dog. And I'd like to share a little more of Boomer Jack's story right now. Now, the Northwestern Pacific operated in two geographical worlds. Its northern and southern divisions centered at the Mendocino County town of Willits. Now, just north of Willits rose the rugged, forested terrain so recently subdued by the track gangs. The railroad clung to the sides of the winding Eel River Canyon, where floods and landslides constantly plagued operations. This was Redwood Country. Such towns as existed were mostly crude lumber camps where snorting steam donkeys hauled trunks to the railway and where a pair of loggers might chop and saw for 2 days to fell a single tree. Now beyond the Eel, the line traversed the lush farmlands of Humboldt Bay Area, ending at the coastal village of Trinidad. Now south of Willits stretched the classic California landscape of Mendocino, Sonoma, and Marin counties, rolling green hills and oak trees, vineyards and orchards, poultry farms and dairy pastures. The rails ended at Sausalito, where the NWP ferries embarked across the Golden Gate to San Francisco. Now Jack's friends sometimes took him on the ferry for a look at the big city life. On one such visit, a train man smuggled him into his hotel room. The management somehow, through a tactless bark perhaps, discovered the unregistered guest and ejected both man and dog from the premises. Soon afterwards, Jack and his friends were walking through the same neighborhood when suddenly he turned through the hotel door to the lobby, raised his leg against the nearest piece of furniture, and strolled out again. Boomer Jack. Now, the San Francisco excursions apparently aroused Jack's curiosity about the wider world, leading to his greatest adventure. He never announced his intentions, but one day simply vanished. As weeks went by, his worried friends realized that he wasn't appearing at his usual stops, that no one had seen him anywhere. They began to fear the worst. Then a telegram arrived at company headquarters from some train man in South Carolina. It said, in effect, "There's a dog running around here with a NWP badge on his collar. Do you know anything about him?" The Northwesterners, immensely relieved, figured out the best connections for his return and wired back instructions. And so the wayward Boomer Jack was passed hand to hand by railroad men across America, all the way back to his home line. Now, the details of his journey east remained a mystery, but he must have begun it by stowing away on the ferry to San Francisco, the nearest hub of eastbound traffic. He returned wiser and more famous to his old haunts. He was in his prime. A photo of young Boomer Jack has turned up in a dusty trunk once owned by engineer Andy Kirkpatrick, who died in 1954. Now, the dog in the blurred picture looks sleek and alert, perhaps a spark of his uncanny intelligence, described by all who knew him, comes through as well. And on July 3rd, 1920, Jack was headed south to celebrate the 4th at Ukiah when he spotted something, a deer or a rabbit, from the window. And just as the engine jolted around a curve, he leaned out a little too far and tumbled from the cab. The distraught crew couldn't stop in time to help, so they scribbled a note, attached it to a signal, and dropped it for the next section gang that happened by. The gang found him, badly bruised and bleeding, his left foreleg broken, and they carefully carried him the few miles north to Willits. He languished there for a month. The most tender nursing by his friends did not seem to help. Fearing they might lose him, they issued a call up and down the line. "Send money. Boomer Jack needs professional care." His arrival by train in Eureka on the 30th was headlined in the local papers. A Dr. Raleigh's veterinary hospital, he finally rallied and became almost his old self again. The call for funds raised far more than enough, so much more that his friends opened an account for him at a Eureka bank. Never again did Jack have to worry about a vet bill. Now, the lameness never left his leg, and he wasn't getting any younger. He began to slow down a bit and spent more time curled behind the wood stove in every station. Mrs. Buck, the clerk at Arcata, has found a photo of him in her family album taken around 1923. He's a little heavier than before, a little more grizzled. But it never occurred to him to quit. As more years went by, he became too old and stiff to jump onto an engine. But when he picked out a train and wanted, he picked out a train and waited quietly on the platform, a crewman would lift him gently into the cab. "Now, what you have to understand," says retired conductor Claude Pinches, "is how much we love that old dog." Although he may not have known it, Jack was not just a lone vagabond, but by this time, the venerable successor to a long tradition of American railroad dogs. Many of the notables are chronicled in by Freeman Hubbard in his Treasure of Rail Lore, Railroad Adventure. There was Oney of the Railroad Post Office, who circled the world in the 1890s, Roxy, the Long Island Railroad, who toured the East for 12 years, and knew Teddy Roosevelt. Admiral Dewey of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford, who covered 50,000 miles in 3 years. There was Railroad Jack of the North New York Central, Patty of the Camas Prairie, Little Hop of the Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis, Santa Fe Jack, and many more. Of this distinguished group, Boomer Jack was a paragon. Few could match him for independence. Most actually belonged to a train man, or length of service, at least 14 years. His total mileage in every direction almost defies reckoning. Now, Bob Brown hired on as a boilermaker at the Willits Roundhouse in June of 26. And it was the following summer, as best he recalls, that he and his shopmates arrived at work one day to find Boomer Jack lying dead at the door of the station office in Willits. He looked peaceful and unmarked. He just ran out of steam, they figured. And Bob collected some redwood scraps from a nearby mill, then helped nail together a small coffin. They buried Jack in the Willits switchyard between the arms of a Y in the tracks and raised a wooden cross over his grave. Word spread quickly, and many friends came by for a last farewell. And soon after Jack's death, the Southern Pacific took over sole ownership of the NWP. The first diesel engine appeared in the mid-30s. 20 years later, the age of steam was history. Now, that's our own Mendocino dog, part of railroad history. And there's a bit more of our local history, and it comes from Engineer Brooks, whom we spoke about last week. We even played his song. Or was that the week before, Lenny? I'm not sure. It was somewhere up there. But I'd like to read a little bit from Engineer Brooks' book called Blowing Smoke Up the Noyo, Rail's Tale. Okay. Now, here's Brooke talking about Mother Nature. Hey, I'm glad to hear the train is coming into the station. Now, Mother Nature hasn't always been kind, either. Landslides, trees down, and washouts. All enough to make an engineer's nerves a little on edge all the time. Especially on the California Western Railroad, where your visibility is 50% or 50 feet, whichever comes first. Now, fires are a big concern, particularly bridge fires. Now, a few times in the past, I've used that washdown hose from the fireman's injector to put out the fires. So someone got a brainstorm and ran a second line to the front of the engine to make it easier to get the fires. Great idea, huh? Well, it wasn't long after its installment that we came upon a fire on bridge 18.57. I put the train into emergency and instructed the fireman, Don Sanborn, to start the injector on my signal. It worked great for about 3 minutes. Then the hose carried away, scalding my legs and groin. Ooh, I bet that's the fastest he'd seen me move. It seems someone had put a low-pressure garden hose on a high-pressure line, which was quickly rectified. In about 1985, Georgia Pacific was logging the hillside above the right-of-way around milepost 5. Now, it's a common practice after the first rains in late October or early November to burn off the slash. On this particular day, it burned more than slash. It burned out the root system of a 30-inch Douglas fir. Now, we had a passenger run that day with two old Pullman and two old Harrison coaches and an open car in the middle making up our train. Our power that day was engine 63, an ALCORS-11. And as we came around the curve at milepost 4.8, my fireman, Ed Freitas, and I were in the middle of a conversation. And we were both looking ahead at a clear track. And something was said, and we glanced at each other. And we looked back. There was this big tree across the track at an angle. Instinctively, I went into emergency and told Ed to get out the back door, which was behind me. By the time he got to the middle of the cab, it was too late, so he hit the deck. I left my seat, heading for the floor, and found myself on Ed about the same time. It sounded like everything on the front of the locomotive was being torn off. It was. Handrails, track lights, and stairway, all mangled. After we got up, Ed said, "Well, thank you." And I said, "Well, for what?" And he said, "For protecting me." I said, "I wasn't protecting you. I had nowhere else to go." Well, on inspection, we found that we had pushed the tree around. It was now wedged between the engine and the bank with the large end still on fire and against our fuel tanks. Well, I got on the radio to Bob Reed, our conductor, and said, "We have to back out of this predicament." And being that he's a conscientious conductor, he wanted to put a flagman out in the rear to protect the train. But after giving him a quick rundown of our situation, I started backing up. It took all of our 1,200 horses to break the lock, put us on, put on us by the wedge effect of that tree. While the crew was getting the fire out, I called the office to report the problem and get us a crew with chainsaws to cut the tree out of the way. Now, while the section crew cut up the tree, we went back to Glen Blair Junction to swap engines so we could continue our trip to Willits. Now, the most common occurrence is having trees down. And every so often, someone will come up to me and say, "Remember us? We were with you the day you had to stop and cut a tree off the tracks." Well, what they don't realize is that I've probably stopped and cut 100 trees out of the way while working here. I would say at least 95% of our right-of-way has trees growing on it. And every year, in October, when the wind and rain start, it's time to start worrying. Is it going to be another 1964 or 1974 or 1982? These are the years Mother Nature has done the most damage to the California Western. Every storm is a potential problem. But those years, the river raised from 1 foot to 6 feet above the rail on the lower end of the river. It's those kind of storms that wipe out bridges, eat into the banks, and undermine the track bed. And every year we get a little snow, most of it at the summit. I've never seen enough snow in our area to cause a train not to run. Now, I'd like to give you a little bit of history of a train wreck that is not in our area, but there is a famous song about this train, and it's called "The Wreck of the Old 97. Now, I've got a little bit of a story here. Actually, this is a story session. I love to talk about the railroads. Oh, I know, train, you really do, and you're doing a good job. Thanks, Greg. Thank you. I always love it when you back me up. But let me tell you a little bit about the story of the wreck of the old 97. And it goes kind of like this. On Sunday, November 2nd, 1902, mail and express train number 97 was placed in service on the Southern Railway, running from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta, Georgia, via Monroe, Lynchburg, and Danville, Virginia, under a contract with the United States Postal Service. The 8-year-old Southern Railroad had competed with the Atlantic Coastline and Seaboard Airline Railroads to obtain this mail contract from the 57th Congress. which required that the mail arrive in Atlanta within a given time limit. Now, should number 97 arrive in Atlanta late, the Southern was obliged to forfeit a substantial sum of money for each minute the train was overdue. Number 97 remained in service on the Southern until January 6, 1907, when it was removed because Congress failed to appropriate funds for the continuance of this special service. And there was no northbound counterpart for number 97. Now, though the train was not old in age, as implied in the song title, it was an object of endearment to the Southern Railway. The railroad officials and stockholders' fondness of number 97 laid with the $140,000 paid annually by the government to the railroad for this contract train, which carried no passengers. Even the engine and train crews were justifiably proud of number 97's average speed of almost 40 miles an hour, including stops. And considering the single track with sharp curves, steep grades, and light rail, 85 pounds to the yard compared with today's 132 pounds. Now, the double track main line from Washington to Atlanta was completed through the Danville area in 1915 and frequently departs from the old railroad bed, Centralized Traffic Control, CTC, resulted in the removal of much of the double track in 1963. So, let's get back to the story. Number 97, reputation as the fastest regularly scheduled train in the world at the time, was probably slightly exaggerated. However, those who may be skeptical of the locomotive's capabilities during this period of railroading are reminded that New York Central Railroad engine number 999 ran 112.5 miles per hour on May 10, 1893. And a train on the Pennsylvania Railroad attained 127.2 miles an hour on June 12, 1905. Now, while discussing the speed, it should be noted that old 97 superior timetable rights over all other trains on each division. All under first class trains were required to clear the main track, pull into a siding at least 10 minutes prior to 97's schedule time, and all freight trains had to clear by 30 minutes. Any railroad employee who was responsible for failing to give 97 a clear track was severely disciplined and frequently had his railroad career terminated. Now, although due out of Washington, D.C., Union Station at 8 o'clock in the morning because of a delay while waiting for mail cars from Philadelphia and New York, or for some other reason, on Sunday, September 27th, 1903, number 97 did not leave Washington until nearly 9 a.m. Try as he might, the Washington Division engineer could not make up any of the lost time. And he finally pulled into Monroe, Virginia about 1 p.m., a full hour late and only 166 miles along the 640-mile track. Now, at Monroe was the northern division point of the Danville Davison, and crews and engines were changed there. Since the regular crew had been assigned to an earlier extra southbound train, an extra crew took over. Afterward, there were several railroad men who, with a mixture of pride and awe, stated that they were supposed to have been on board number 97 that fateful day. Now, engineer Joseph Andrew Steve Brody, with his two firemen, they climbed aboard into the cab for the run to Spencer, North Carolina. 168 miles away, with a normal running time of 4 hours and 15 minutes. Steve Brody, a Mason, was a tall, slim, single, 33-year-old boomer engineer with a pleasant personality. Originally from Saltville, Virginia, he had been on the Southern for only about 1 month after leaving the Norfolk and Western Railways' Pocahontas Division. located in the very mountainous terrain between Bluefield and Williamson, West Virginia. And prior to his NNW employment, Steve Brody had run on the Seaboard Airline Railroad, North Carolina, division between Raleigh and Monroe, North Carolina. The term boomer is a description of Brody's drifting from one railroad's employment to another, as did many railroad employees during this heyday period. Frequently, this was necessitated when one's employment was terminated for an infraction of the operating rules. He bore the nickname Steve after a daredevil named Steve Brody, who was reputed to have won a bet by jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge several years before. And although this well may have been Brody's first run with number 797, it was definitely not his first run over the Danville division, as has been rumored occasionally over the years. Frequently, Casey Jones, also immortalized in song, has been mistakenly identified as the engineer of Old 97. John Luther Casey Jones of Memphis, Tennessee, was the engineer of the Cannonball Express on the Illinois Central Railroad when killed in a collision with a freight train at Vaughan, Mississippi, at 3:52 a.m. on April 30th, 1900. Casey, like Steve, was trying to make up about 1 hour of lost time on a southbound train at the time of the crash. Now, Brody's assigned fireman was Albion G. Buddy Clapp, a single 33-year-old dedicated Presbyterian from Whitsett, Alamance County, North Carolina, who had left farming to fire on the Southern about 2 years earlier. At the time of the crash and his death, he was engaged to marry Miss Mary Stanley, a school teacher in Greensboro, North Carolina. Now, Miss Stanley was later the principal of White Oak School in North Greensboro for many years, but she never married. Assisting Fireman Clapp on this run while learning the duties of a fireman was student fireman John Madison Hodge, about 21 years old, a white bachelor from Raleigh, North Carolina. Many reports have erroneously listed his name as Robert Dodge and stated he was black. Now, the train crew consisted on the conductor, John Thomas Blair. It consisted of conductor John Thomas Blair, 37, of Spencer, North Carolina, and a flagman, James Robert Moody, 30, of Raleigh, North Carolina. Like Steve Brody, a flagman, Moody had previously been employed by the Seaboard Airline Railroad. Brakeman D. Franklin Ingram of Gretna, Virginia, was called for duty on number 97. Fortunately, he failed to report for some reason, and number 97 left without him. Brody was definitely not ordered to put her into Spencer on time, as implied in the song, since no dispatcher would ever have been issued such an order, and because it was impossible to make up any appreciable amount of lost time. It is remotely possible he received an order to run 1 hour late from Monroe to Danville to allow other trains additional track time in accordance with standard dispatching procedures. Leaving Monroe, number 97 consisted of a locomotive number 1102, two postal cars, an express car, and one baggage car used for the storage of mail. This was all the very latest equipment, as this pet train deserved. Locomotive number 1102, a 460 class F-14, equipped with a chime whistle, was built by the Baldwin Locomotive Works and number 22633 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and shipped to the Southern on August 21, 1903. Now, at Lynchburg, 6.8 miles south of Monroe, number 97 made a scheduled stop. Wentworth Amistead, about 17 years of age, and employed by the Southern Express Company as a safe locker since the previous December, climbed aboard for his daily task of locking the safe after all valuables were loaded. Now, the practice of entrusting only station employees to lock and unlock the safe was a precaution against the possibility of a train robbery in the Royal area. Now, he was then supposed to get off. On this particular day, however, the train started rolling before he could do so. Possibly this was due partially to an anxious conductor Blair and engineer Brody trying to make up a few moments of the precious lost time, and partially to their unfamiliarity with the procedure at Lynchburg. Regardless of the reason for this premature departure, Armistead decided to stay on the train and ride on to Danville, 65.3 miles south of Lynchburg. Apparently, he planned to return on a northbound passenger train, number 36, later in the evening, rather than further delay number 97 with a second stop. Number 97 left Lynchburg at 1:27 p.m., an hour and 10 minutes late. Number 97 blasted southward through Evington, Hurt, and Sycamore, with her firebox roaring and the safety valve whipping a white feather of steam into the gray smoke flowing in her wake. Witnesses later described the train as moving in a pillar of dust sucked up from under the track due to the tremendous speed. Apparently, number 97 stopped at Franklin Junction, now Gretna, briefly for water. Now, according to the Danville Bee, on September 28th, 1903, during this stop, Ralph Thompson, the 12-year-old son of postal clerk John L. Thompson, got off number 97. Now, although his presence on the mail train would have been strictly against the rules, reportedly young Ralph was being given a promised ride by his father and got off at Franklin Junction in order to return to their home in Washington, D.C. on November, on number 36. Immediately after the crash, there were conflicting reports as to whether Ralph Thompson or Wentworth Armistead had gotten off at Franklin Junction. For reasons forever unknown, young Armistead chose to ride on to Danville. Number 97 stepped quickly away from the water stop and resumed her rush to doom, roaring through Whittles by Chatham and Dry Fork, over White Oak Mountain, and past the Fall Creek Depot, now remodeled and known as the Old 97 Steakhouse, without slackening speed. Lima, which was located at the present north city limit of Danville on Route 41, Franklin Turnpike, was the last station passed by number 97 on this run. You know, the ballot refers to, it's a mighty rough road from Lynchburg to Danville, and it lies on a 3-mile great, well, that may have been distorted over the years and possibly should be, and at Lima, at a 3-mile grade, which was certainly correct. Well, in Pennsylvania County, near North Danville, stood Stillhouse Trestle, built in 1874. This trestle carried the single-track main line over a ravine through which meandered Stillhouse Creek, not Cherry Creek, like some have reported. The southern cross is Cherrystone Creek, about a mile south of Chatham. Now, this shallow, rocky creek bed lay about 45 feet below the deck of the crescent-shaped 325-foot trestle. Also in this ravine, about 50 feet from the southern end of this trestle, was a building at the Riverside Cotton Mill. Approached from the north by the 3-mile descending grade from Lima and in the middle of a sweeping curve beginning about 200 feet to the north of Stillhouse Trestle, was considered one of the most dangerous spots on the Danville Division, although no train had wrecked at there before. Mr. James I. Lee of Lynchburg, Virginia, a retired civil engineer for the Southern, recalled drawing plans for filling in the ravine under the trestle on June 17, 1903. And over 3 months prior to the wreck, of course, these plans, which were never implemented, would not have prevented the tragedy. Near both ends of the trestle were signs warning approaching engineers to reduce speed. And on that warm, peaceful Sunday afternoon, just before 3:30 p.m., number 97 was due at Danville at 1:50 p.m. The train did not slow, but approached the curve and trestle at full speed. Estimates of the train's speed range from 35 to 80 miles per hour, with the 90 miles an hour, well, referred to in the song, being a bit unrealistic. Approaching the northern end of the trestle, the locomotive derailed and soared through space, traveling over 100 feet before landing and coming to rest on its left side in the rocky creek bed. The four cars followed, crashing down on top of the wreckage, and during the plunge, the telegraph wires adjacent to the track were torn apart, temporarily disrupting communications. Mr. E. F. Carter described a long whistle blast from 97, her farewell to the world, as the most horrible sound I ever heard. Many witnesses recalled this whistle scream, which may have been tended partially as a signal to the train crew to apply the handbrakes on the cars and partially as a warning for the Henry Street crossing about 400 feet north of the Stillhouse Trestle. As E.E. Lester, who was a 20-year-old grocery clerk at the time, he later retired after his career on the Southern, and he recalled, "On that Sunday afternoon, I left my house at 315 Ferris Street, 2:30 p.m., and just as I reached the crossing of the main line of the Southern Railway on Henry Street, I heard old 97 coming down the deep Betsy Rice cut about 1/2 mile from the crossing. I stopped to watch it pass, as I'd done many times, and I saw that it was coming much faster than usual at this point. I watched to see the engineer would ply the brakes, and not until he had almost reached the crossing did I see sparks fly from the brake shoes and the wheels. He was then 75 yards from the sharp curb trestle around the old Stillhouse branch. I knew he would never make the curve, for he's making some 40 or 50 miles per hour. He left the track just before he reached the trestle. Engine 1102 landed on the opposite bank of Stillhouse branch. There was so much dust and steam, I thought fire had broken out. And when the dust and steam began to clear away, we saw a man crawling out over the top of the express car. The three men in the engine were so badly scalded by the hot water and steam that they were all the same color. It was a horrible experience. One last anecdote. The first thing I noticed on arriving at the wreck was canary birds flying about. Then I ran down the hill near the branch, and there I found a young man lying on his back, under what looked like a part of the side of a mail car, and trying to pull himself out with his elbows. I ran to him and raised the planks, but he wasn't able to pull himself clear. He said to write down his name and address for him. I got my pencil, ran about 50 feet, and picked up a paper sack and shingle and ran back to him, but when I got there, he was too far gone to speak. The only way I can describe him is he was fair-complexioned and wearing a beautiful ring with a bloodstone for a set. Now, at this time, I'm going to take this opportunity to pick up my guitar, which is sitting right over here. And I would like, to actually sing for you the ballad of old 97, or the wreck of old 97. And here we go. Well, they handed him his orders in Monroe, Virginia, St. Steve. Way behind time. This is not 38, but it's old 97. Put her in dispenser on time. Well, he turned around to his black greasy fireman. He said, shovel in a little more coal. And when we reach that Stillhouse Trestle, you watch old 97 roll. It's a mighty rough road from Lynchburg to Danville. Lies on a 3-mile grade. It was on that grade that he lost his air brakes. See what a jump he made. They was going down grade about 9 miles an hour. Whistle broke into a scream. Well, he was found in the wreck with his hand on the throttle, scalded to death by the stain. Well, a telegram come from Washington City. Is it how it read? You know that brake engineer that run old 97 lying in old Anvil land. Hey now all you ladies, please take warning this time now and learn.
never speak harsh words to your true loving husband. He may leave you and never return.
That's right. And that is the story and the song about the old 97.
Well, a drunkard lay on the barroom floor. He drunk till he couldn't drink no more. He fell asleep with a troubled brain, and he dreamt he was on the hellbound train. Hellbound train, hellbound train, hellbound train, woo, bound train. Fell asleep with a troubled brain, and he dreamt he was on the hellbound train. Now the fireman, he was a crazy tramp. The headlight, it was a brimstone lamp. Tank was full of lager beer. The devil himself was the engineer on the hellbound train. Now the engine flew at a horrible pace, brimstone burning hand and face. Worse and worse the roadbed grew, faster and faster the engine flew on the hellbound train. Well, he blowed that whistle, he rung the bell, and the devil said, "Boys, next stop's hell." All the passengers yelled in pain, begged to the devil, "Stop the train!" Hellbound train, hellbound train, hellbound train, hellbound train. And all those passengers yelled in pain, begged to the devil, "Stop the train!" Now the devil, he laughed at their misery, hollered and he yelled and he roared with glee. "You paid your fare with the rest of my load. You got a ride to the end of the road on the hellbound train. Cause you robbed the weak, you done wrong to the poor. You turned hungry folk away from the door. Made up gold till your purses bust. Ruin young gals with your beastly lust. Hellbound train." Mocked at God with your stubborn pride. Murdered, killed, cheated in your lie. Double-crossed partners, cussed and stole. Belong to me, body and soul. Hellbound train. Now you paid your fare at that Shawnee bar. You're gonna ride in the devil's car. This is one time I am no liar. I'll carry you all to the land of fire. Hellbound train. Hellbound train, hellbound train, hellbound train. This is one time I am no liar. I'll carry you all to the land of fire. Your bones will burn in the flames that roar. Scorching, you'll sizzle from the rind to the core. The barroom rang with a horrible scream. Oh, as that drunkard woke from his terrible dream. Oh, down on his knees on the barroom floor, he prayed and he prayed as never before. And his prayers and vows were not in vain, and he rode no more on the hellbound train. Hellbound train, hellbound train, hellbound train, hellbound train. Prayers and vows were not in vain, and he rode no more on the hellbound train.
Oh boy. That was Malachi playing flute on that one, by the way. You know, we have a lot of local talent here, and I did take a lot of time with that story. But before we close this, I'd like to run this particular show out with one of our local talents, Mr. Bruce Burton. Now, he's got a CD out there right now, and let's listen to a little bit of Mr. Burton's. This is Take the Long Way Home album, and this is called Spring Valley. Stuff. We have so much talent in this town, and I'd like to be playing some more of Bruce's music later on. Ah, yes. Well, I want to make a comment right now about members. Everybody out there is a potential member. This is a community radio. We underwriters, programmers. I want to thank Bruce, by the way, for his support so far, donating some incredible materials to get this station on the air. Now, this program will be happening KLLG LP 97.9 in Willits. We'll be repeating this at 10 a.m. on Thursday. 10 a.m. And we will be doing it 8 o'clock Sunday night, the Bipolar Express. Hey, Lanny, do you have anything to say about this station? You've been really quiet today.
No, we're coming into the home stretch. I got all wrapped up in old 97, but here it is. Say goodbye, Greg.
Goodbye. Ooh.